Hello, it's the Help Show. Yes, we're finally here. We're a little bit late. We've had some teething troubles in the new studio setup, but that's because there's a computer over there that's playing my voice 3 seconds after I say things, and it's putting everyone off. And we've got a new studio. Here we are. Look, you see? It's fantastic. It's colour-coded behind me, and we've got the six people here on the screen, and it's all reversed, which is why I was going to point left instead of right, and we'll get used to it. My left shoulder's disappeared, but based on the fact I could do with dropping a bit of weight, that's no bad thing, is it? Discussing the Help Show, the questions that you've sent in to us, we've got an esteemed panel. Top there, we've got Carrie Holtzman, who's a fantastic PC tech, and was complaining earlier on that was only two questions for him, but we've got another one in, so don't worry about it. Next to him is Paul Shadwell, who's a tech in Switzerland. Carrie's in Arizona. Paul's in Switzerland. Paul Wright, who you all know from The Big Show, who is the only person who keeps East Anglia University, is it East Anglia University? Norwich University?
University of East Anglia.
University of East Anglia, my apologies, from falling flat on its face. Darren Griffin, who is the man who owns Pocket GPS World and also a drone builder himself, as well as, and our own Paul Wheatley, bottom left, who's looking a tad washed out at the moment, unfortunately, but that's...
It's because I live in Scotland.
Yeah, we'll fix that, though. That's bad bandwidth as well, doesn't help with that. Kicking us straight off, then, we're in. I've got a question here. Dear Help Show, I've bought one of those Bluetooth transmitters that you can plug into auxiliary outputs, and I've got a Bluetooth headset that I can pair to it. However, the instructions on the Bluetooth auxiliary output actually say pair using the safety code 0000. How am I going to get the earphones to pair to the output from the auxiliary Bluetooth thing? Regards, Ewan.
Sorry, is this a self-help group?
Oh, mate, I've got about eight or nine of them tonight with all the crap I've been doing this week with the new studio move around. No, I bought, because me and Paul Shadwell sat down on the internet the other day on Skype, and we sussed out, if we possibly could, a Bluetooth thing, because I carry an earpiece in for doing the show. Here you go, it's just in the side of my head there. But it's always on a cable that's shoved in my back pocket, and the cable breaks. Every sort of 6 weeks, I end up buying a new cable. So I bought a Bluetooth thing with Paul, and we figured that would do it, so it can plug in, and then I can put a set of Bluetooth earphones in, and away we go. But the problem is, the things come through, and it can be powered off USB, it's all fine and dandy, it works just perfectly. But when you pair, you've got to put in 0000 as a passcode. Any suggestions? Apart from getting me money back.
So I can understand this. So you've got a set of headphones.
Yeah.
And you're trying to pair them with your phone.
No. So basically, when I do the shows, I have to have an earpiece in so I can hear you guys.
Yeah, so you pair them with your Mac, right?
And I'm cabled to the mixer. What I want to do is plug the Bluetooth transmitter into the mixer, and then it's going to transmit a Bluetooth signal of the audio that I can then pick up in earphones that are Bluetooth earphones. Uh-huh. But I can't pair the two together, because one wants a 0000 passcode. You put them both into pairing mode, and there's no way to point one towards the other.
But so both are receivers then, neither's a sender?
No, the one that's over on the thing is a transmitter, not a receiver.
That seems very odd, because, I mean, I don't know any headphones that would allow you to put in a Bluetooth code.
Well, exactly. That's my point. So, but Paul and I spent ages buying the right one, and it works. So Paul hasn't done anything wrong, and I haven't done anything wrong. The problem is I can't pair it to a... they're both blind, effectively. They're looking for computers, so...
Okay. So, I don't know. Maybe we should have gotten this question beforehand.
No, I'm just joking. I didn't expect anything useful out of you five. Jesus.
I didn't let you down.
Didn't have to be any instructions with it, was it?
Yeah, it said flick it until it goes red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, and then put 0000 in the receiving device. So Yeah. Weird stuff. Have a think about that, and anyway, there we go. Pairing should be automatic, surely, says Jufro Jim in the chat room. And that's all he said. That's the only person who's offered any advice whatsoever. There you go. Yeah.
Generally, though, I think if I'm you're knackered. Flicking something and it's red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, you're doing it wrong.
Okay.
Whatever you're flicking and it's doing that, that's wrong.
We need to move on. Dear Help Show, first question is from Josh in Virginia. Thank you for your question, mate. I think you're going to get a few requests, though, on this one. I've installed a new sound card in my PC, and every time I start a game, I get a circle in the middle of the screen with sound bars that are jetting out. Jetting out doesn't sound good to me, I have to say. I can't get rid of... That sounds like it's a Sinclair Spectrum game loading. I can't get rid of it. The bars appear to be related to the direction of the sound in the game. E.g., if I'm playing a game and someone is talking to me from the right, bars jet out to the right. It's driving me mad. Love the show, guys. Josh, Virginia. And Paul took that question in from the Gamer Show and has put in, I have replied to him asking for the make of the sound card, so do be aware of that when we give the answer.
Yeah, so he came back and said it's an NVIDIA sound card.
Ah, right, okay, there we go. Yeah, so I've installed a new sound card in my PC, and every time I start a game, I get this circle in the middle of the screen with sound bars jetting out. Now, what's there's the first description for me. I don't understand what a sound bar jetting out is.
So a graphic in the middle, a graphic overlaying the game, then, is it?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, Paul. I've seen that before, that some sound cards kind of give a graphical representation of where the audio is coming from in the game. I'm assuming it's some kind of accessibility type thing. So if you're, you can also use it for like kind of Call of Duty games, as I understand it, as kind of a cheat. So if you don't have surround sound or something like that, and somebody's kind of sneaking up behind you, this graphic in the middle of your screen can actually show that the audio is coming from behind you. So it can be used in that kind of thing. That's all I can assume that he's describing.
Anyone else has got anything else?
Jufro Jim in the chat room says, sounds like a sound meter decibel response. I don't know if that's the official name of what I've just described, but there you go.
I suppose the fair thing, that we have, because obviously with a lot of the NVIDIA stuff you plug into Windows PCs, the first thing that it'll go and do is sometimes go and get the Microsoft driver. So it's whether it's that generic driver or the specific one that actually came with the card itself, isn't it? They do that sometimes, don't they? It automatically goes off and gets one.
Would that cause that, though? That sounds a bit specific. I'm no expert. I'm throwing out the devil's advocate question here, but
I did a little bit of Googling this afternoon when he came back to me, and all I can find is how to disable it once it's appeared. So you basically hold control and press zero, and that toggles it on and off. But I can't find anything that told me exactly how you switch it off all the time.
You've got to assume if it is an accessibility setting, it has an off button.
I'm assuming
that kind of defeats the object otherwise. We're definitely not saying glitch, though.
No, assuming that his description is accurate, we're interpreting his description accurately, It sounds like it's one of these things that shows where the audio is coming from. iBooker in the chat room says Doppler radar for gaming, so I'm assuming that's the correct thing. You hold down control and press zero to switch it off once it appears on the screen. But how you actually fire the game or whenever it's appearing up without it by default, I do not know. Let me just see if I. But the best thing I could find is that's how you switch it off as soon as it comes on.
Anyone else got any thoughts?
Well, normally in the control panel, doesn't they add a little app that you can go into that for all the settings?
Yeah, it normally sticks down in the taskbar, doesn't it? In the bottom right.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Oh, right.
Go on.
Sorry, I just as we're speaking, now that I've got these names that the guys in the chat room have been putting in, apparently you should be able to find, just as Paul Wright said, you should be able to find something in the taskbar. And when you go into that, there should be two buttons at the bottom. It should be called something like a radar or something like that. And when you go into that, there should be a little thing that looks like a Wi-Fi signal. I'm trying to describe this because I can't put it in the chat room because it's on a separate machine here. There should be something that looks like a little circle with a Wi-Fi thing in it and one that looks like a cog. If you go into the cog, that allows you to set up the shortcut key to disable and enable this functionality whilst it's in-game. But to switch it off altogether, you sort of uncheck the symbol that looks a little bit like a Wi-Fi. What I'll do is I'll see if I can find this graphic or find some way, some magical way of transferring graphics or screen grabs from one computer screen to another in my office. That seems to be the way to fix it.
Okay. Yeah, no, good. Well done. Thank you. Jim in the chat room, I think we've put Jim onto something because he says it sounds cool and he wants to know how to do it. And Windrider's replied with accessibility control panel question mark. I'm guessing that they're guessing, so don't take us at face value on that one.
I'm seeing something called...
Go, Karen.
I'm seeing something called Sound Radar, which is on ASUS ROG boards, Republic of Gamers boards. Doesn't seem to be something related necessarily to NVIDIA. It looks like it's a motherboard thing. And they said it was for hearing impaired players of games to be able to know where the sounds are coming from.
Right. Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
But the question, there was some discussion of whether or not it should be banned because they thought it was a form of cheating.
Yeah, that's right.
I've never heard of this before. This is the first I've heard of this.
Yeah, it's cheating if the deaf people don't suffer. Jesus Christ.
Because on Goat Simulator, it seems to me that...
Goat Simulator.
It always goes to Goat Simulator.
Sorry, I won't finish this.
Okay, I've just... I found a version of this graphic here that I'm just going to tweet out again because the chat room's in a different device. I really should find a way of syncing all these devices.
But you've got Wirecast, you know. You could use the virtual cam off Wirecast and then you could share your desktop.
Had we thought about that prior? That would be
no. Of course, we hadn't. That would require preparation and planning, Paul, which is just not something that we do.
So I've just tweeted out to you guys. You'll see. I'm not quite familiar with what that game is, but you'll see. It maybe looks like kind of. Don't know. Anyway, up in the top right hand corner, I think that's what he's describing. You'll see the red circle with the kind of the blue, as he describes it, sound bars jetting out.
I see.
I'm assuming that's called a sonic radar, which is what
there
looks
is.
Like.
Switch that off. I do have a picture.
Cool.
I have a picture. I'll just resize it so it fits. There you go. It's a sonic radar, top right corner, apparently. There we go. Is everyone getting that? That looks like the sniper game or the modern warfare game, doesn't it?
Darren, thank you very much for popping that in the chat room.
Brilliant. Cheers, Mr. Griffin. You know you can speak as well.
Yeah? I know. I'm seriously being quiet. I'm surrounded by women in my house, so I'm seriously being quiet.
You're not surrounded by any men here either. They're only here because their wives let them. Thank you. Josh, send us any more information if you want any more, and sell us if it works as well. That's the one thing. We got a nice feedback last week saying that it worked, so but do send it through if it does. Dear Help Show, is there a way to have a hotkey setup to eject all my external drives? I've got a 2011 MacBook Pro with two external drives, Time Machine and Music Library, attached to a 2012 cinema display. I don't think the year matters on the cinema displays, but when I want to move my laptop, I need to open Finder and eject both external drives before safely unplugging the hard drive. Is there a way that I can just hit a key or a series of keys to unplug my laptop? Thanks, Ian Mitchell, Morpeth. I'll start with that one, because I don't think the cinema display matters unless you're running the hard drive through the cinema display. And if you are running the hard drive through the cinema display, I know from my own cinema display, which is over here working at the moment to the right, it gets very significant issues with drives being attached directly to it. If it goes through a hub and then it goes into it, it's fine. But when I've put drives directly into the back of that, I've had problems with startup because it doesn't want to start up. It doesn't want to wake from sleep. And I would have said that probably the best thing to do, isn't there a Doug script that's for eject?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there is an Apple script that will force eject all the drives in the system.
Yeah.
Yeah, go to Doug's script and try that one.
Yeah, if you don't want to do that, there is an app in the App Store called Undock that does the same thing. It's a free version of one for £1.49 called Undock, and that will eject all drives as well.
Brilliant. But for those of you that think that we're absolutely stunning on this show as well, by the way, we do get the whole day to actually go and look for stuff on forums. But
actually, I just found the Apple script command line.
Oh dear, here we go. Have you got it? Does it start sudo?
So Windrider in the chat room saying command E, but you have to actually have the drive selected.
You've got to know which
want
drive
to eject to press command E. But that does work. I think in the scenario, Ian would still have to open up Finder, select the drive, and then hit command E, I believe.
Go on, Paul. You were about to say that you found the terminal. Go on.
Yeah. So you say tell application Finder in quotes eject every disk in brackets. End tell. So if you write that into a little file and then run it as an Apple script, it will work.
You're talking to the bloke whose Hello World is still in beta, according to Joe DeMac. So how do I do that, right, mate?
Well, one of the things you can do, you know, every Mac comes with Automator.
So yes, I love Automator.
Do it in Automator, and then you'll be able to assign it to a hotkey.
Right. Well, that's pretty cool. Would you write a blog for us on that, Paul, and stick it on the...
Sure.
So there you go. Look out. We've got a blog that runs in comparison with the show, or in parallel with the show. in opposition to the show, maybe. So go and check us out on that and subscribe to it, because we've got the help show that comes out on the feeds that you see in iTunes, the video show and the audio show. But then we've also got a help show blog, and I wrote a piece on Thunderbolt. These guys have written stuff on filming stuff in landscape as opposed to portrait. And that was a dig at you, Paul, but never mind. You never wrote that.
It was actually, to be more accurate, it was a dig at my sister-in-law. So.
But we've got a blog that goes along with it. So anyone here that comes up with a solution, if it's worth making a little kind of routine out of or stream, you know, a sequence, we'll try and write it as a blog and get it posted. So everyone's got access. So, we'll get that up as soon as we can. Thank you, Paul, for that. Well done. D. Ewan, not all my Apple TVs showing the iOS remote app. They are all on and work fine, they just don't show. Immediately after a reboot, they show for a couple of days, but then they vanish. I can't... There's a lazy bastard Apple TV that you've got there. I can't find a setting in the remote app to refresh or update or check again. What might be causing this? I've recently changed my router, which is an unrelated issue, but this made no difference. Am I stuck with needing to reboot all my Apple TVs? Five of them. I got three and I thought I was bad. Every few days. Tim Caulfield, St. Ives.
There was an issue, but this is a couple of versions ago with the Apple TV. Would do things like lose connection, and also because we use Apple TV in the office for doing... in the conference room for displaying the Mac screens up on the 55-inch TV, and we would be in the middle of a presentation and all of a sudden it would drop the connection.
No!
So that's actually gone away, though. In the last two updates, they fixed it.
So you're suggesting an update here would solve the problem?
On the Apple TV, yeah.
Okay. It's always worth doing anyway. Always keep your software up to date for security as well.
Yes and no. I mean, yes, it should. Yeah, in principle, yes. However, if you've got it hacked in some way, then you can't go up to the latest version because some versions of the jailbreaking software don't work on the latest versions of the TV software.
But this isn't hacked, though, is it? Teams isn't hacked.
Well, it doesn't expressly say that, but yeah, okay.
Do you know Tim? Is that what you're saying?
No. I don't. I don't. no. What I'm saying is. That there's a chance. Okay, so what I'm saying is, if other people are in this situation, we can't just say that I am updating it will fix all the problems, because that may cause other problems for them. Do you know what I mean?
If you have an unjailbroken Apple TV that you bought from the shop and did nothing with, just plugged it in, then you can also turn on automatic updates so that it will pick it up on its own as well.
Excellent.
I just find the whole thing quite flaky. I'm getting a little bit bored of my Apple. Sorry, I'm kind of going off on a bit of a rant here, but I'm kind of getting bored of my Apple TVs. I'm sick of looking for that bloody controller. Lose it.
all the time. And my app works fine, actually, but then it's the pain in the arse I haven't unlocked my phone and fire up the app. I'm seriously considering moving over to an Amazon TV or something like that.
Oh!
Actually, well, then you'll have the same problem, surely, if it's only the remote that you're having a problem with. I actually have a Logitech, one of those remotes that you can set up for all of the devices that I have, like the amp, the Sky TV, the TV itself, the amplifier. It also works with the Apple TV.
Does it? Is that Harmony? Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
The Harmony works with the Apple TV now?
Yes.
Well, they just got 100 quid in.
Has forever, as far as I know. I've always had one.
Well, no, because the thing is, I had a Harmony TV application long before the Apple TV came out in the pocketbook format. And we had a lodger who stayed with us, and he dropped it on the floor and broke it, and he never bought me a new one, the bastard. So he still owes me for that. So I've never bought another Harmony one because they're crap, because they break when you drop them. So I need to get another one, clearly. But if they do Apple TV, that's great, because then there's nothing worse as well than tapping in your bloody code if you haven't got a Bluetooth keyboard assigned to it.
Also works with the Xbox and the PlayStation.
And I'll give Apple 100 quid just to get rid of the frigging front row interface still.
I hate that thing.
Just hate it.
I'm seriously considering super gluing my Apple TV remote to the back of my Sky remote, because I'm never going to lose that.
You can flip them.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you could do an under button press thing. You got your left and right are screwed, but I mean...
You could be like, you know, Jim Carrey and the cable guy. You know, when he's tuning in all the TV stations and he's kind of doing both thumbs on either side of the controller. Always wanted to be able to do that.
Excellent.
Just send a tennis ball to it. Might never lose it then.
I mean, there's a question here about Apple TV. I mean, I've got to say, we're joking apart, the front row interface, the lack of wraparound on menus and things like that, it's still frigging annoying, and they've done nothing with it for 5 years.
They've added extra channels and stuff.
Yeah, but that's not a change in the OS.
No. Well, there is rumours that something's going to happen next month at the WWDC, Apple TV-wise. But it is a rumour.
I just they've got to get rid of that front row interface. It kills me. I hate it.
I actually love my Apple TV, just so you know.
I love it as well. We sit and watch tons of Netflix, and we love all the movies, and we buy loads of movies. We've got 60 movies that we've purchased from it since we turned over. But I just cannot get on with that, you know. And when it just, especially when Netflix loses your account and it goes, oh, you just need to put your password in. A, what was my email address that I signed up with? B, what was my password that I signed up with? And then when you've actually typed it in three times and realised you were wrong, or you've typed it in three times and you were right, but you've actually typed it wrong, but you haven't seen it.
I think one of the coolest features of the Apple TV for me, especially with Mavericks, is that you can now have your TV as an extension of your desktop.
Yeah, I've never tried that yet. Does that work well?
It works really well. It's a bit slow, I have to say, when you drag things onto it, because it's TV, but it works. It works really well.
Oh, you buggers, you just cost me 100 quid.
Why?
Buy that remote now.
What, that Harmony one?
Yeah, bloody hell. That's what I've been after that. Oh, crap.
Jufro Jim says, stay away from the product design. All right, mate. You're a help show, not a design show. Shut up.
Fair enough.
Ken in Airdrie, one of your kinsmen here, mate. Might be a Wallace. He said, I have an external hard drive plugged into my Windows 7 PC as a backup, but I'm not very good at remembering to run one. Are there any free solutions out there that can do this for me that are easy to use and can be scheduled to do it on a daily basis? Carrie, start us off this one, because you're the Windows man here as well.
Well, the trick is free. You know, I have a concern, really, with anybody who's making backups that wants to automate them, because I'm, as a fan of technology, I don't trust it. So, really, the only backups I trust are ones I make manually. That said... the other issue or concern I have with somebody who wants to automate backups is that you're leaving your backup drive presumably plugged into your computer at all times, which means that if there were a fire, a theft, a flood, a virus, the backup drive would be lost in the same catastrophe that would require the backup to begin with. So a way around this would be to rotate backups, to have one always plugged in and then take one somewhere out of the building. A better solution, I think, would be to use a service like Carbonite or Mozy and just let it upload to the cloud, unless you're backing up huge amounts of data such as movies, pictures, music. That could be a situation where you have more data than you can potentially upload. Then the question is, what do you want to back up? Are you wanting to make a system image where you can restore everything from square one, in which case Acronis can't be beat, but it's also not free, which doesn't address this specific concern. Or you can use a program like GoodSync, where you do file synchronization, which you can use for free. And I believe you can automate that, or you can set it in task scheduler or something like that to back up the My Documents folder, the Favorites folder, and specific folders of your choosing, versus Carbonite or Mozy, which many of those, I think Carbonite automatically selects the most common folders by default. So if you're one of those users who doesn't know where your data is, that's another solution. So
good luck getting dressed in the morning.
Straight answer here, because there's so many different variables that are involved. There's no one way to back up. And backing up is just another way of saying making copies. In fact, I don't know why we in the computer industry have to come up with our own words for things that already exist, but it seems to put off a lot of people because of the terminology. So let's just clear this up, that all you're doing is making duplicates of things that are important, so that if the duplicate gets lost, or if the original gets lost, you have a copy, or what we call a backup. Now, some people ask, why are we backing it up? Well, because you don't know why the data could be lost. It could be lost because of a virus or an accidental deletion. A hard drive failure may be the most common reason. There's an endless array of variety of how your data can be lost. And the one thing that everybody who's ever lost data has in common, they all have one thing in common. None of them expected it. So you always prepare for the worst, hope for the best, keep the data offsite on a regular basis as much as possible. I would not recommend plugging a backup drive into a computer and leaving it there without rotating it and taking the, like I already mentioned, taking one drive out of the building, take it somewhere else. Or if that's all too much trouble, use a cloud-based service.
I think the one thing you've got to understand is what your propensity is for loss of the data as well. I mean, for me, I spend a lot of time. So I've gone out today and I've shot a conference. I've filled 32 gig cards, SD cards, and I've got a 32 gig card that was in the sound recorder that I put down near the lecture podium that was recording audio constantly for the whole afternoon. And for that, for me, I've got 90 gigs worth of data there potentially that I'm going to stick on my laptop and store for the ride home, because I'm not going to leave it on one SD card. I'm going to put it on the laptop before I come home. And then, well, okay, if they want to steal my laptop, I've got my SD cards in my pocket. So, you know, if I get mugged, my laptop's gone. And it's that ability to understand how much you're going to lose and how you're going to lose it potentially.
And well, and here's the other
try and lose
thing.
Try and lose it no more than a day's work is the key.
Well, look, I the question's like, how often should I back up? I think this is an individual decision where you have to ask yourself, if I lost everything today, would I be okay from my last backup? Okay. When the answer to that question is no, that's how often you need to back up. When it comes to people that say, well, I don't know about putting my data out there in the cloud, is that secure? I would ask them, are you encrypting the data on your backup now? And usually I get a blank stare or glazed over eyes. And I go, chances are you're not backing up, you're not encrypting your backup data now, which means if anybody steals your backup drive, they have full access to all of your data. So by putting it in the cloud, the thing that you're afraid of being insecure is actually more secure than the way you're doing it now, unless you're technically of a level where you understand how to use encryption. And if you are, you're probably not the one asking this question. So I do believe those services are secure in that it's simply security through obscurity, in that there are so many other people using that service that unless you were a public figure or a celebrity, there's no reason for anybody to isolate you. I mean, nobody knows who you are. Why does anybody care? And at the same time, the data is encrypted. So even if the data were to be stolen, that wouldn't be any good to the thieves without the encryption, the decryption codes, rather, to decrypt it. And, you know, when you get things like the CryptoLocker virus and you've got your backup drive plugged into your computer, guess what? It's going to encrypt everything on your backup drive. It's going to encrypt everything on your NAS over your network. So one of the things that you can do with the online backup services is versioning, where you can go back to the previous version of the file. And there are utilities that will do that as well, though I'm not aware of any that are free. Windows 7 has, you know, the pro version has some versioning built into it for like office documents and things like that. It gets kind of complicated, but ultimately what the bottom line is, if it's important to you, make copies, put those copies in another building on a regular basis that is determined by you.
Hmm.
And that's the bottom line.
Anyone else got anything to add on backup?
Well, like Carrie said, it's that thing that they don't think it'll happen to them, because we had one last week where it wasn't going to happen to them, a drive fail, and it was £1,500 to get it back. And especially where I work, you say to people, well, sort your backups out, because what I say to them, what's your research data worth to you? And it's probably worth tens of thousands of pounds. But a lot of people don't think, and everyone's still carrying around portable hard drives and plug them into the machine, and that's not even their backup, it's actually just their data, because obviously with a lot of the SSDs and things now, obviously they're not very big. A lot of the laptops got 128 gig drives, and they're putting everything on these hard drives now, and it's terrifying really to see that people think actually it won't happen, and where, you know, Google Drive is giving away the 100 gigs for £1.19 a month. And you could easily just put your stuff in there. It's terrifying, really.
Yeah, don't get me started on the old cloud backup thing, because I've got specific issues with that. But you know, my laptop's carrying 2 terabytes of storage in it, which never backs up. So
I'm forever going out to customers who've got problems with their Macs, and you get there, the Mac's hard drive's failing, and I say, "Well, where's your backup?" I haven't got one. They got the pictures from all the kids' births, you know, the marriages, everything on there, no backup at all, and the drive's days away from, you know, dying completely.
Right. Well, and again, and your situation, Ewan, isn't it a prime example why there's no blanket one-size-fits-all backup solution for everybody? Everybody's needs are different. Now, I would say any backup is better than no backup, all right? Even if you're doing it what I consider to be the dangerous way, at least you've got something. And in most cases, something is better than nothing. But in other cases, depending on the type of data loss, it may have been, like I said, if it was alongside the computer when your house burned down or someone broke in and stole it, then it just went with everything else.
But I think one of the things, I mean, Jim's saying in the chat room here, and Booker is chipping in saying about the crypto virus, the same thing, and the fact that you're backing up viruses, not just, and if you restore, you restore to the virus point. But that's not really something that's ever really that bothered me. I'm fairly diligent on what I click on anyway, but I'm fairly satisfied I don't have a virus on the computer. But the issue that you get with it is the fact of, if you set up something as an automatic backup, if you've got something which is doing it by itself, when would you notice that it hasn't done it? Because I've had this with ChronoSync. I set up automatic backups. I find out a couple of days later that it hasn't backed up, because I look for a specific file and it's not there on the backup drive. And I'm not. This is not a criticism of ChronoSync or any other of the backup systems. If you're solely relying on something to do it, the problem that you have is that you then rely on that thing to do it, and when it doesn't do it, you're in deep poop because it hasn't done it. And every program, I don't care what you've got, every program has a glitch where it forgets to do something. It doesn't run a schedule. It doesn't follow the exact pattern of what you wanted it to do. It's not a specific criticism at all, but when do you notice? Because if you think it's doing it all the time, when are you going to see that it isn't? And that's your key problem.
Yeah, I mean, there are programs that will email log files and whatnot that get around that. But, you know, it's not like the dishwasher didn't start when it was supposed to. We're talking about your data here. Yep. Data that's important enough to you to back up, I think, is important enough to you that you should be a regular, I don't know the word for it, chaperone to ensure that it's being done. And even do what we call a fire drill from time to time, where you try to restore your backup and emulate a disaster recovery to ensure that you've backed up. What if it's backing up exactly like it's supposed to, but you've realized that, well, your Quicken data is in a Quicken directory in the program files subfolder instead of in the My Documents where it should be. And you don't know that until you go to do a restore and find out all that Quicken data is gone. There are situations like this I've encountered with clients, contact lists from email and such that weren't in the standard directories, and they didn't realize that until the restore happened. And hard drive data recovery, as was previously mentioned, very, very expensive. There's a guy out here in L.A. who does $300 data recovery, but he can't recover. He says he can do about 80% of the drives that get sent to him. But even then, a lot of people don't want to pay the $300. It's interesting how people put a value on their data. And, you know, there are pictures, for example, and I love the example of the birth of a child, something that you can never recreate that. It's the only copy of those photos. That's it. Put them up on Flickr. Put them up on Facebook. Put them out somewhere out there. If they're photos, it costs you nothing. And to rely on an automated process, I don't know. There's a plus to that, too, though. There was somebody who had their iPhone stolen, and they had everything going with iCloud, and all the pictures the thief was taking were automatically being uploaded to iCloud. And through that, they were able to track the person who had the phone.
That wouldn't be you suggesting that Apple stuff's really good, would it, Gary?
Really expensive, I would say, but... yeah, it's good, but it's expensive.
A couple of comments in the chat room. Mac Vader's saying Macs can still get infected. I know, I'm just fairly sure that mine aren't because I'm running Sophos. And if you're not running Sophos, it's a free piece of software from a fantastic firm. Graham Cluley's been on this network and done a fantastic show a couple of years ago on viruses for Macs. They give it away free of charge for all Mac users. Go to sophos.com and download the free Mac antivirus. It is free. It doesn't use loads of cycles. It just sits and purrs away, updates itself, scans, works just fine. Catches window virus as well, so go get it. So your VM's secure as well. iPad Gaz says, going back to the Apple TV question, to stop it from dropping off the wireless network, go to Settings, General, and change Sleep to Never. This should resolve your problem.
I'm not sure it would, because when you read the thing, it's not. It's saying that it's actually working fine. It's just that it's not appearing in the note in the app.
Sleep does cause a few problems with quite a lot of computers, doesn't it? You know that when they sleep, they die on occasion. I know my Hackintosh does, but that's a different thing. It's not supposed to. We'll give it a try, and if it works, let us know, and we'll let everyone else know. If it doesn't, then, well, call Paul. Next question. This is a bit of a long one, unfortunately, or fortunately. It's from Phil in Leicester. Dear Help Show, brackets Ewan, like you, I think of no end of apps for the morning motion. But although some might be pretty cool and actually be useful, I've no idea where to start. I'd like to ask the panel what to do... Two, A, write down, draw the app, whatever, I want to make so that it's understandable if I approach designers. So first question to the panel is, if you want to develop an app, how do you express yourself? How do you get that out to someone so that they can make sense of it and can then accurately quote you or at least understand the kind of output that you expect? I mean, I'm a photographer, and the one thing I'm manic about is getting a brief. Some give great briefs, others don't give great briefs. But, brief is the key. Paul Wheatley, you're the app developer here, so, and Darren.
No, I'm not an app developer, but I can. But I would say Darren's the app developer. But my entire job is based around the first part of this question. The first thing you need to do before you even worry about drawing the app is to exactly... identify what it is your app is going to do, and try and kind of put that into basic speak, such as what are the things that the user is going to be able to do with this app, and try and boil those right down to some kind of key statements that say this app is going to do X, this app is going to do Y, and this app's going to do Z. And then also think about some of the things you might want to do as an admin to the app as well. Once you've got those down, that should really kind of focus your mind into what at the very core is this app going to do, and perhaps even will allow you to break it into sort of version 1, version 2, version 3, and so on and so forth. Once you've done that, then start to kind of sketch out some ideas as to how the pages are going to hang together. And if you've got the budget, it would be good to sort of like maybe put that in front of some people to start playing with. If you don't, stick it in front of some family members or something like that, purely as a paper. Just explain it, because frankly, you're never going to get an interface.
You're talking about just draw it out on an A4 sheet that you've pulled out of the printer?
Yeah, just draw an A4 sheet that you pulled out of the printer. Because at this stage, if you can't explain to somebody how this what this app is and why they would want to buy it at this very, very basic level, then your app's too complicated. You need it to be get right down to its boiled down state in paper and pen. Once you're comfortable with that, you can then take it into tools like Marvel or PopApp. And basically what they do is they allow you to take photographs of those sketches and create little hotspot areas and allow you to string together those sketches. So you've taken a photograph of the first three screens. You can then go to screen one and select a little hotspot area that you can tap on, and that will then load up screen two. So this is assuming it's an iOS app, by the way. I'm assuming there is similar things for Android and things like that, but I've never dealt with them.
So the question does like go on to cover iOS, Windows, OS 10, and Android. It's not.
If it's an app in iOS, you could do that kind of thing. You can also use, there's tools like Azure as well if you want to kind of get more heavyweight, which is a couple of hundred quid or something. Marvel's really free. PopApp's free. There's other things you can use, like Keynote has huge amounts of libraries that you can use for to create sort of very, very basic prototypes that you can allow to be clicked through. And all these things, Marvel, Pop, Azure, Keynote, and everything like that, are all tools that you can use as a general member of the public with a little bit of computer knowledge. And I'm assuming if you're going to go so far as to create an app, you've got basic computer knowledge anyway. And also if you're listening to this network, you probably have too. And then you could take that to a developer at that stage with the user requirements that you wrote down at the very beginning. And that should give you enough of a brief to be able to at least start talking to a developer about this.
Darren, anything to add?
No, I think as Paul says, a clear brief is the most important thing. You need to know exactly what it is you want the app to do. You need to be able to convey that to at least a developer. If you can't explain exactly what it is you want it to do, then you're almost hiding to nothing. But exactly. How you actually approach developers is a minefield at the moment, unless you've got a massive budget.
Well, that's the next part of the question that we're getting onto. Approach a developer sounds like a Yellow Pages exercise, but I've got no idea how I'd call or where I'd get the number of a developer. Any ideas? Well, we've got some developers here, but I mean, or people who can develop. But I mean, presumably, when you select someone, you've got to select someone you trust. I mean, the one thing that I picked up on, and this goes back to a point that maybe Paul was alluding to, I don't know. I've got some apps for the Morning Motion that might be pretty cool and actually be useful. So Phil here hasn't said that he's trying to make money out of this. He's saying I've got something that's a good thing to do and that people might find utilitarian. Yep. So he's making the app for the right reason, but then at some point he's got to cross swords with the economics of this, and that's where the developer thing probably turns nasty if you're not careful and you pick the right person who's someone that you can trust and you know and
yeah. So I mean, there's a reasonable chance that, again, making an assumption here, that if this chap listens to this network, it is a chap, isn't it?
Well,
I'm just making a wild assumption there that it's a bloke yet. So if the chap listens to this network, there's a reasonable chance he's techie and he probably has some techie friends. Kind of reach out there and see if you can get any recommendations of your friends and developers. Although, being that at no point in this question we've defined what sort of app we're talking about.
No, he does that later on as well, because I don't think he has a specific app.
I think you need to probably think about where your target is at this stage, and that kind of comes back to Ewan's point about monetization of it. I mean, you've probably got more chance in making some cash on iOS at this stage, and to a second degree an Android app. And then that's totally changing who you're going to speak to, unless you're dealing with something like PhoneGap, which is a different thing I'm not going to go into just now. But so maybe reach out if you can't get any recommendations of your friends of developers that they know. The other thing you could do is to reach out to some user groups. So for example, if there's an Apple user group around you or an Android user group, or you could find there's all sorts of other user groups that deal with different sort of programming languages that you could reach out to them and just go along to one of their meetings and start having a conversation with them. And just as a starting point, and just know about them, what they're doing, and things like that, and you might actually start to make some connections there.
Yeah, I mean, that's all good advice. I think the next bit as well is quite an interesting one for me as well. If I approach a developer, what do I ask them to provide? How do I know that they won't provide? And how do I check what they've provided? So, I mean, no, because there's a good point there in that what's the scope of the... I mean, again, it goes back to even my own world. What's the scope of my provision? What are you paying me to give you at the end of today? And there's a lot of people, if you're not careful, that, you know, I've learnt it over many years of getting it wrong, they'll come up to you and say, oh, I thought you were going to do... And you're like, no, you said, you showed me, here's what you sent me that you wanted it to look like, that's what it looks like. Well, yeah, but we wanted something different. Well, you didn't say that, you know? The scope is everything in the provision.
It's the brief. It's the brief.
Well, it's the brief is sort of what the app wants to do at the end of it, but how far do you want the developer to take you down that path as well as? Yes, it is in scope, but
well, so that's kind of where the prototype comes in, where you can actually hand them, for all intents and purposes, a working version of the app. Now, there's all sorts of variables there, because rarely do people think about error screens and all that kind of crap when you're doing a prototype, because you're just thinking about the happy path, the perfect journey. But, you know, if you're handing them a solid prototype that is exactly what you want it to do, it's exactly all the screens you want for version one or whatever, then, you know, you're sort of a reasonable level there. But the other thing to think about, it's not just about it looking the same, and if you push that button, it does this action. You've also got to think about the how well it's coded in the back end. You know, if they've written poor code, for example, and probably Darren will be able to explain this much better than me, but if they've written poor
code, what are you
code,
saying, it'll like?
Perform badly. Sorry?
What are you saying? Well, if they've written poor code, I'll hand this one over to Darren.
No, that's not what I said. I was saying that if they've written poor code in some way that effectively does what you want it to do, but it's going to be sluggish. It's not going to perform on all the devices. You know, it's just that I've experienced that where we've kind of trusted a developer. They've produced a final product, but then when we had third party code review on it, it was named and shamed in quite a heavy way.
Right, Darren, anything to add?
We develop our own apps. We don't take in commissions, so we make all our own mistakes and we can only kick ourselves for it. So it's
good.
A different, very different, really.
Yeah, excellent. Last part of the question. There is another part, but how much would you estimate for me to get my app to market? I know this is a piece of string, but say I wanted a document-based utility with some storage in the cloud and syncing with multiple other devices running the same app. I'm not sure we're going to give a very good answer here, potentially, but I mean, how much would you pay developers for that kind of thing? I mean,
how long is a piece of string, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is.
I mean, but, okay. So there is no ballpark even for a couple of grand or?
I have no plans.
The next part of the question is, does this change with iOS versus Windows versus OS X versus Android? Is Windows a cheaper platform to develop for because of the prevalence, or is it just courses the same thing?
Well, I mean, I'm no expert on this by any stretch of the means, but you've got a lot more competition in the Windows world. It's easier to get lost in that mess that's out there of the competition. And because anybody can write anything any way they want, it's hard to convince people you're not a virus, that you are safe. The potential that your program could cause harm with another program as a result of poor programming is always going to be there on a Windows platform. So there's a larger potential market to sell it, depending on what the app is. I mean, if the app is something like WhatsApp, I mean, you know, that's not really useful on the Windows platform. But a lot of these apps are specifically designed for smartphones and tablets, primarily smartphones for the portability nature. Since you don't necessarily have a full-fledged...
And you know nothing about smartphones.
Sure I do. I got my smartphone right here. It's right here.
That Razer V3?
That's... No, I've upgraded. I've got a Samsung...
You just love a flip phone. You just think you're in Star Trek, don't you?
That's right.
Yeah, there we go.
If I could just get Scotty to beam me out of here right now.
Oh, absolutely. Every show we get him on that. Every show we get him. Dear Help Show, from Simon in Chester. Dear Help Show, after I boot up my PC, it takes forever before I can do anything with it, and it's just generally unresponsive. Any steps that I can take to speed the whole system up? Don't come back with Biomac, for God's sake. Jesus Christ. Anyone got anything for Windows PC that takes forever before it can do anything?
Do we know anything about the computer? Is it what version of Windows it's running or how much memory it's got?
That's the whole question. I'm sorry to say. If you do send us a question, please, please, please try and put more information in as much as you possibly can, because we do struggle if we don't know. Josh, we got his email address, so we wrote back and he wrote back in time, but Simon, we've got nothing back from. Just a generally unresponsive PC. Normally, I mean, this is going to irk you a lot, Carrie. I understand that. Don't get me wrong. But I had Windows PCs many years ago when I first started because I couldn't afford anything else. And I've got to say that backing up all your data and then just starting again made an immense difference. And even on Mac, you know, once in a while, just getting all the data backed up and then going, do you know what, let's just get everything off and start again, and hoping that you don't forget to deactivate a piece of software that you've got, does make a huge difference. But you're not a proponent of the complete refresh, are you?
No, I believe in fixing a problem. What you're doing there is potentially creating a new problem, especially if you don't know the technical ability of the person asking, because they may not understand what a driver is, where to get a driver. How do you get your network card driver so you can get your other drivers if you can't get on the net to get the driver unless you have another computer to find the driver? And then you're going to have all the updates that are going to be missing, and then you're going to have to reinstall your antivirus, and then all those little tweaks and things like your wallpaper and your settings that you've configured, and reinstalling Chrome or Firefox and all your plugins, and it goes on and on and on and on. And every program you've installed, like say you've got Adobe Professional, and the amount of updates that you've got to do just to install that and activate it, and Office and the updates and the activation, and Windows and the updates and the activation, it is a full day job for people who know what they're doing. So my advice, as a general generic cleanup, what I would do is run there's a free program called CCleaner, mm-hmm. available at ccleaner.com. It used to be called Crap Cleaner, but they found it wasn't a very media-friendly name, so they changed it. And I always get the portable version, which is kind of hidden. You've got to scroll to the bottom of the page. It'll say other builds. The reason I use the portable version is it's important that whenever you use CCleaner, you're always using the latest version. And if you install it and you go to use it a couple months later, it may not automatically update. It should, but if it doesn't, you could cause harm to the computer because an update may address something that gets broken with some other software update that CCleaner then has to address. So always use the latest version. I use the portable version. You can go into your Windows directory under software distribution, under download, and you can delete the entire contents of that directory. Now, if you've got years of updates in there, they're already installed. You can still uninstall the updates, by the way, if you need to. I don't even know why this doesn't happen automatically. You can completely delete that folder out. That'll free up some hard drive space. Adding memory generally always speeds up a computer. If you have less than 4 gigs of RAM on Windows 7 or Windows 8 or Windows Vista, I would recommend at least 4 and a maximum of 8. Generally, you don't need to go more than 8 gigs of RAM unless you're doing something very memory intensive like photo, video editing, rendering out architectural drawings, things like that. So for most people, 4 is the basic and 8 is the optimal for most people. RAM is very easy to install. If your computer is crashing and you think adding memory is going to fix that, it's just going to crash faster when you add more memory. Okay, so don't think of that as solving any problem. Now, the other thing you can do is you can click on Start and or the little Windows orb and type msconfig, that's short for Microsoft Configuration. Look at everything that's starting when the computer starts. And some of that you may not understand what it is, but you can Google it and figure out if it's something you want starting. You might have Skype starting every time your computer starts. You may have Garmin Express that updates your GPS running it, that you do every once a year, that starts every time your computer starts. These are not things you need to have starting every time your computer starts. You can click on Start or the orb and type %temp%. That's going to open up your temp file, a folder. You can highlight everything in there and delete it. Anything currently in use, it won't let you delete. There should be nothing in there that you will miss. Go into your Internet Explorer Internet options in the control panel. Reduce the amount of Internet cache. By default, Microsoft used to set it to 3% of your hard drive space, which got ridiculous. I recommend changing it to any two-digit number. By default, now it's at 250. I would change it to 25 or pretty much whatever number you've got in there, change it to any two-digit number. You don't need that much Internet cache. The other thing that you can do to speed up a computer would be to ensure that all the updates are installed for all of your programs. Every single program that you've got, you can generally click on Help in About or Help and check for updates, whether that's Chrome or Firefox or Adobe Photoshop, whatever it is that you use. Make sure you update all that. And one other thing that bogs a computer down is antivirus. So what I recommend for people is if you're paying for antivirus, stop paying for it. To me, antivirus is like the mafia of the 1920s Prohibition era. Norton is like Al Capone. He just kind of looks around at your computer and goes...
Just do be careful that we're not subject to the same laws for libel as you, mate.
Well, I'm not suggesting having no antivirus. What I'm suggesting is...
Just say some antivirus can...
Well, I'm just using an example, and this is my personal opinion, okay? This is not coming off as fact, and I'm entitled to my opinion. And my opinion is that it's that these paid antivirus companies... Does that make you happy?
That's good.
These paid antivirus companies are like mobsters. They're saying, hey, you got a pretty nice PC here. That'd be a shame if something were to happen to it. So you can get free antivirus. You can does the free antivirus work as well as the paid antivirus? Well, since no antivirus can protect you 100%, none of them are it's like saying I'm going to go buy a Volvo and that way I'll never get in a car accident. I don't have to bother to learn how to drive. It doesn't work like that. So ultimately, you have to make the right decisions behind the keyboard, and as much as you've got to make the right decisions behind the wheel of a car, you just don't go buy a safer car and figure you're exempt from following any rules of the road. So my advice is get a lightweight antivirus program, especially on an older computer. Now, you can get Microsoft Security Essentials for free, and a lot of people will say, well, that antivirus is crap. That's like one of the worst ones. And they're absolutely right. It is. But it's also very lightweight, and if you combine it with another product like Malwarebytes, and you can get a paid license for life, they're still available. They stopped selling them, but they're still available. There's still people at stores that have inventory that hasn't been sold yet. You get a lifetime license, and then you can add a web browser add-on called Web of Trust, which is at mywot.com. Okay, so you got four layers of protection. You've got your Windows updates, your Web of Trust, which will let you know when a website has been rated as dangerous by the community, which is free. Microsoft Security Essentials, free for the life of the computer. Windows updates are free for the life of the computer. And the Malwarebytes with the lifetime license is going to catch all the stuff. Really, that's going to be your main antivirus program. And you get your lifetime license, you're good for the life of the computer, and you're done paying this protection money. And since a lot of these programs, these paid antivirus programs, are trying to throw in everything. They're trying to throw in password saving and cloud backup and firewalls. And you end up with a program that's bogging your computer down. And just sometimes removing that paid antivirus program will make the difference in the performance of the computer, in my experience. So there's a few things you can do.
Excellent, mate. Thank you very much. Anyone got anything to add to that with the... The chat room's a bit biased towards Mac, it has to be said.
Yeah.
Windrider says nuke it from orbit. And Bookery says microwave the hard drive, then toss it into Mount Doom and buy yourself a new hard drive and do a fresh install if it's Windows.
No. But another thing we've seen, because he's saying obviously, you know, Kerry's right about the startup stuff, but obviously going back to the antivirus. Some people do think, because it's free antivirus, it might not be as safe as a paid one. So what they'll sometimes do is install a second free antivirus program. So and when you've got two antivirus programs running at the same time, that will make your PC very unresponsive. When people come in with that, we double check. And they've got Avast and AVG running at the same time. But a good way to check that, and also the startup stuff, is if you go to pcdcrapifier.com, it will scan all those startup files and remove them all for you automatically. So that's a good way to see kind of what software you've got and what is starting up if you're not confident going to msconfig and pulling those startup routines out.
Cool.
That's a good tip. Also, you could run a junkware removal tool, which is free from Bleeping Computer. You can run Adware Cleaner, ADW Cleaner, which is also free from bleepingcomputer.com. That won't hurt to run either of those. And then finally, the old-fashioned go to Programs and Features and look through the list of installed programs. If you see anything that says Toolbar, remove it. If you see anything that says Conduit, remove it. If you see something that you know you don't use anymore, remove it. So what we're doing is we're just, you've got a donkey and you've got it overloaded with all this stuff, and the donkey can't move that quickly. So if there's stuff that's packed onto that donkey's backpack that you can remove that you don't need for your journey, your donkey can move a little quicker. That's kind of the theory behind this. By going into the programs and features, what I still call it add remove programs from XP days, and just looking through that list, if you don't recognize it, you don't know what it is, leave it alone. And always make sure you only have one antivirus program installed, because they will fight against each other and they will slow your computer down.
Good question. Good answer. Thank you very much, sir. Next question is on Twitter. It's from Rob Cunningham in Newcastle. Why has Twitter stopped allowing URLs in DMs? Surely you only get spam if it's someone who's a dick. And why would you follow someone who's a dick? If you don't follow them, they can't DM you. I love the logic, Rob. Thank you, mate. Why has Twitter... when we say help, we'll try and help you with technical knowledge of certain things that maybe some of us know, photography, et cetera, et cetera. Company policy, I'm afraid we don't know anything about. But has anyone got to postulate why Twitter's stopped using URLs in DMs? Because I've got to say, I haven't got a clue either.
Just to make my life more difficult, I think.
It's supposed to be
stop always spamming. Either, because last week I was sending you and links in a DM in Twitter and it was working, but other times it won't work.
It's not app based though, is it? So Tweetbot will send it once in a while. Twitter never sends it for me, but Tweetbot does periodically.
Oh yeah, it's Tweetbot I'm using.
Yeah, see the Twitter app never sends it. I never get anything out on Twitter.
And it's absolutely right. It makes absolutely no sense. Why make do that in the DM?
Yeah, you're worse off in open.
Hey, bizarre.
There we go. We didn't solve anything there, but never mind. Last question then, before we finish. I'll do a quick sponsor read here, UK2.net. I need to get a better logo or better setup than this, because they've got a new logo which doesn't have stuff to block everyone else out. UK2 have sponsored us for a long, long time. They're brilliant. If you can, please, 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 any business you've got for web service, you know, domain name, co-location services, a server, shared servers, direct servers, VPS, VPN, please go and check out UK2. Do it through our website, britishtechnetwork.com. Then we get the kudos for sending you. There's also a ton of offer codes. If you go to britishtechnetwork.com/sponsors, there'll be a whole string of stuff there that you can put in. You can effectively zero your cart, 20% off domain names, and £50 off your first for first server month. There's loads of stuff. Go and check them out. They're absolutely brilliant. They are supportive of us. That's the key part. They take away the cost of running a dedicated server that has an immense problem with downloads and brand bandwidth. So please, please, please support them. They're absolutely brilliant. And please also support the Network Union. They are the people that help you if you've got BT Business Broadband. Now, I do the read on them, but, you know, they provide the service in here that takes up the live shows and sends it back out to you guys. Further than that, I don't know an awful lot about what they do, but what I know is if you've got BT Business Broadband, and it doesn't matter how big your system is, go and check them out, because they can help you get the right service from BT. Make sure that you're getting what you pay for. I went to my accountant the other week. He said, we're with a firm, but I'm sure we're not getting what we pay for. So I got him to speak to Robert at the Network Union, and Robert said, no, that doesn't sound right. So Athos said, right, as soon as we're out, we're going to come over and have a chat with you. And then they'll help you with your WAN or your LAN or whatever you've got going in the office as well as. So go and check the network union out. Go to the sponsors page again, use the click-through, and give them your email. And they will tell you if you've got exactly what you're paying for. They'll tell you, no matter what you want to know about BT Business Broadband Services, they can help you. Your relationship with BT is still there, so you're still paying your bill to BT. This is an extra layer of support that's shoved in the middle. We love them. And they're also chucking an awful lot of money our way on the Patreon thing as well as, which is wonderful. And Ian Ross, you still haven't sent me an email. Claim your prize, mate. You've got to send me an email that says your address, and then I'll send you the speaker bag, because you did win last week. Mm-mm-mm. I'm not sitting out unless you listen. If you don't listen, I'm not happy. Right, there we go. Last question. It's a question about TeamViewer. From your experience, could you answer any questions about TeamViewer 9, the free version? I'm sure you've dealt with some of these issues in corporate networks before. First one, file access restrictions. Is there a way to prevent access to parent computer to sensitive files and folders in the child computer, similar to Windows permissions on a network? Because I couldn't find anything about it in the manuals. Ooh.
I use TeamViewer a lot. I like it. I use it regularly. The idea behind TeamViewer is that it's emulating you're in front of a remote computer using the keyboard and mouse. So restricting any files would be no different than restricting the files themselves from the user. So I would say that the user should encrypt those files with something like TrueCrypt that would solve that problem if they didn't want that person remoting in to access them. Again, the idea is that we're emulating sitting in front of that computer. So to the best of my knowledge, that would be the only way around that.
Okay, fair enough. Anyone else? Anyone use TeamViewer?
No, I didn't use it. We got our own setup. So, but yeah, Carrie's right. There's not a lot you can do because it's almost like physically being in front of the machine. So
you've got access to everything that's there.
Yeah.
If you really want to. Does TeamViewer have a backdoor for unattended use password recovery? Can a password be reset without email verification?
Maybe. If there's more than one user account and you can log in remotely to one of those user accounts, then you should be able to reset the password to the other user accounts through that. However, if there's only just the main account and that's all there is, you're not going to be able to boot, because TeamViewer only works in Windows, and to reset the password for the single account, you would have to do that with a bootable type CD or something that could do that before Windows loads.
But, I mean, surely you wouldn't start TeamViewer and then find someone on the internet, hi, I'm you, and have at it.
If somebody were to call you and say, I've forgotten the password to my computer, can you remote in and fix it? I could foresee that as a potential thing. However, in a corporate environment, that should all be controlled at the server level anyway. So, because didn't he start this off saying something about a corporate environment?
Did he?
Yes.
So in a corporate environment, all the passwords are stored on the server versus the local machine. So that doesn't really apply. So in that case, you could log into the server remotely and change it on the server. But if we're talking about just a single workstation with a password on it, anything that requires booting outside of the Windows environment, TeamViewer is not going to load. TeamViewer loads in Windows.
Next question, VPN security. How secure are remote and file transfers both with and without VPN over open, unsecured public networks like a coffee shop?
Not very.
Zero.
No, if it's over a VPN, you're probably fine.
You think?
Sure. If it's an encrypted VPN, yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of a VPN is that... You can, you know, I ran an experiment at DEF CON, which is the hacker convention in Las Vegas. And I said, you know what, I'm going to just check my email real quick. I'm going to log in and log out so fast they won't even know I did it. Well, stupid me. They've got automated processes that are monitoring the network in milliseconds. So the minute I signed in and signed out, it already had my login name and account password. And I was on what was called the Wall of Sheep, which lists every moron who's checked their email at a hacker convention. Mm-hmm. And an open Wi-Fi, you know, at the hotel's Wi-Fi. And what I ended up doing is I installed RealVNC. Now, this is before the days of TeamViewer, LogMeIn, and Instant House Call, et cetera. and RealVNC encrypted the connection then from the Wi-Fi to my computer at my house, and I was no longer on the wall of sheep. They could no longer, the automated process at least couldn't crack that. So if you're on a VPN, then what you do through the VPN is secure. So if I'm at a coffee shop using the free Wi-Fi, and I use an encrypted connection like TeamViewer, LogMeIn, et cetera, what I do will be completely secure, except for the people who are looking over my shoulder. You know what I'm saying? Like what's happening behind me? Someone could be looking at
me. Yeah. You can't stop
but as far as sniffing the traffic, it won't do them any good. It'd be like me picking up the phone and talking a different language to somebody, and you could overhear me, but you couldn't understand anything I was saying.
Okay. The question is specifically about TeamViewer VPN.
Oh, is it? Right.
Well, TeamViewer is encrypted, and so therefore the VPN is also. I think by the very nature of a VPN, the P stands for private. So by the very nature of a VPN, I believe all VPNs are encrypted.
Okay, fair enough. Good question. Thank you, Charles, for sending that one in. Do appreciate it. The Bash is coming up. What are you doing on the 11th and 12th of July? Because what you should be doing is on the 11th, you should be coming up and joining us at 5 p.m. at the Kismet Curry House, the best curry house in the entire world. And Milan has decided to put on for us the back room. The function room is ours. However many people come. The good news is, last year we were about 27 people and we packed the place out. We can get 80 people in that back restaurant. So there's a lot more tickets available this year. You can then come in, have a few beers, have a few drinks, and then Milan is going to spill out a pile of starters to choose from and a buffet-style thing, and then we'll sit down and have a sit-down meal in the normal way in the evening. There's a little garden out the back. It's not huge, but it's there. And all you've got to do is order a Bash ticket for the curry, and it's £10. And that's a deposit, so you're going to get that back, because whatever we get in the way of deposits for the curry is going to come back to you in the evening. So it'll come off the bill at the end of it. I think, Darren, you were there last year. Good curry?
I was, yeah. It was superb.
Yeah. Nice. Righty, you missed it, but Paul Wheatley?
Yeah, it's awesome.
I didn't think you were... In fact, actually, I don't think you ate anywhere else, did you?
No, I didn't.
So that's the 11th. The 12th is the proper Bash, and it's down in Birmingham, B36 area of Birmingham. If you want to book hotels in the B36 and B46 areas of Birmingham, then that's the best place to do it. There's a Toby Carvery that's just over the road from the Kismet, which is perfect, and it's a £4 taxi ride to the venue in Water Orton, which is down. It's a village hall. And it's a really good venue. It's got a big hall that we can go in if it actually decides to rain. But we've avoided the British Grand Prix this year, so there's a good chance that we won't have rain. There's the key part. And we can, we've got a pile of stuff down there we can put up. And we've got a big garden that we can go around, and it's a family day. Under 16 is getting free of charge. Everyone else is £25. The reason you're £25 is because we haven't got any sponsors this year. We had TechSmith last year, but we've got no sponsors at the moment this year. So we need to make sure that we can at least cover the costs of it. We're not making any profits or anything like that from it. If there's money left over, because we do get a sponsor, then we'll give it back to you on the day. Don't worry about it. But please just support us if you can. The tickets are on sale now. Sarah's done a great job on the cart. All you got to do is go to the homepage, britishchatnetwork.com, click on the buy now tickets or order your tickets now, and it'll take you through to a cart and your PayPal cart, and you pick what you want, how many tickets for each event that you want, and then you pay with your PayPal address, and that's it. It's all in, and you've got your ticket, and it's bought, and I'll send you the ticket just before the event. 11th and 12th of July, make sure you come in, because last year it was immense fun. It was really, really good. We can only do 200 people, though. So at the point we get to 200, it's going to be cut off, I'm afraid. So if you want your ticket, now's the time. Don't mess around.
One of these days, I'm going to make it there for that.
Do it.
So
you
jealous.
And Michelle should be over here, mate. You should be over here. It was a great day last year. It was absolutely fantastic. It was really, really good. Right, it's time for the cool tip. Now, we do cool thing on the big show and the Mac show and that kind of stuff, but this is the cool tip. So this is the thing that you think people should do, and it's not a product, it's not a sales pitch or anything like that. It's the here's a little thing that you can do that gets you started and does fantastic stuff. Anyone want to start us off?
Yeah, I'll give it a go.
Go for it, righty. What you got, boy?
Well, after all the Connor Hartley stuff and everyone kind of changing their passwords, I was looking at solutions because someone asked me how to keep their passwords safe, and they're selecting one password and LastPass, but some people don't want to pay money for their security. But it's a little open source thing called Password Safe. It's just a little program where you can create an encrypted little password file, and it creates a little database, and you can put all your passwords, usernames, and like that, and it works like LastPass. And you have a master password that obviously encrypts everything. Stick it in your Dropbox and have this little bit of software running on all VP. It only works on PCs, but that it means that you obviously you can have really highly encrypted passwords, and you don't shell out any money for it. And you're all safe. Mate.
And what's it called again?
Password Safe. It's passwordsafe.sourceforge.net.
Excellent. Good stuff, mate. Excellent pick. Who's next? Darren, you'll start.
Yeah.
Yours is interesting. This has got me piqued, I have to say. Tell me more.
Mine's are really simple. And recently, I had to sign a load of electronic documents to lease my car, and they wanted the signature. And I was scanning around for quite a nice, simple way to add the signature, and I came across the fact that Preview supports signatures, which I didn't know until recently. Mm. So if you go to the Preview app in OS X and open the preferences, there's a signatures tab, and you can use your EyeSight camera to capture a signature. Just write on a little piece of card, hold it up to the camera. It captures it, saves it, and you can save multiple signatures, and they're available to right-click in an Adobe PDF in Preview, and you can drop a signature onto the page, resize it, put exactly where you want, bosh, done.
PDF is way more Preview is way more powerful than people think, because they look at it and they think it's PDFs only, but it opens 28 different file types. It is massively, massively versatile.
Yeah, it's a great app.
One of the things that I did at Macworld was I told the assembled crowd about how PDF saved my backside one day. I was in a field and I pulled out the SD card from my camera, shoved it in my MacBook Pro, and it wouldn't read it. So I was like, okay. So what shall I do? I plugged the camera in. So I had a cable, great. I can plug the camera in using a USB cable. Nothing would see it. No apps would see it. iPhoto wouldn't see it. Aperture wouldn't see it. There's absolutely nothing. What are we doing here, then? I need the software. So I ring up Canon because I've got a connection, but when I go to the website, I can't download the software. And I'm going about a little while now. But the guy from Canon says, well, you need the original discs, and then you can prove that you've purchased the camera from us, and then we'll send you the software. Why would I be looking for the software for a Canon camera if I didn't own a Canon? I'm lost on that. Well, that's
Well, and if you had the original discs, why would you need the software to download?
Thank you very much, Mr. Holtzman. So I'm in this field. I'm in a friggin' field, you know, and I'm not going to go home and get the discs so that I can do this. I need to do this now. Can you help me? No, I can't. And the one thing I suddenly thought was, let's try Preview and let's try and go see if we can get the train drivers to pick up it as a scanner or God knows what. Preview was the only application in OS X that saw my Canon camera, and without opening all the files, it imported all the files from my camera and put them into Finder as RAW files. Massively versatile program. Saved my backside, and I cannot say enough good things about Preview.
That was one of the things that sold the Mac in the office, was the fact that we didn't have to go out and buy the expensive Adobe Acrobat to manipulate PDFs, because it's in Preview. You can do that. You can take pages in and out of a PDF. You can move them around. It's all native in OS X.
It's a good tip, mate. I really like that. Preview's I'm a fan of Preview, I have to say. Good tip. Waiters, what have you got for us, boy?
So it's kind of a quick and simple one, and it's something that sort of makes sense when you think about it, but it's something that I didn't realise did what it did. So on an iPhone, and I'm assuming an iPad actually, but I've never tested this. On an iPhone, you can use the volume up key to take the take a photograph, but that only works in the camera app, so it doesn't work like if you're taking a photograph native in Facebook or Twitter or something like that. So it only works if you're using the native camera app. But basically, anything else you have attached to that device with a volume up key does exactly the same thing. So, for example, if you want to do a remote photograph, so say you've got your camera on a tripod of some kind sitting at the other side of the room and you want to get like the family photo and things like that together, you could get an app or something like that, just some kind of timer delay. But actually what's really, really simple is you just frame the shot up and then take like a Bluetooth keyboard or a Bluetooth headphones or Bluetooth headphones or something to that effect, anything that's got a volume up key that's wireless, and if you hit that key on the keyboard or on the Bluetooth headphones, it takes a photograph. Equally, that works if you the standard headphones that are plugged in, but it also works with Bluetooth things. That also works for starting video as well for exactly the same purpose. So
cool.
I recently discovered this, and it makes total sense, but I was quite blown away with that.
Dad, why are you always holding that keyboard in every shot?
I was just about to say that.
So I'm saying keyboard as an example, but you can also use like Bluetooth headphones.
Any Bluetooth like. Device will cause a camera trigger.
If it's got a volume up key, so like some of them don't have volume up keys.
That's a really cool tip. Mm. I like that. I'm going to play. Definitely.
I'm going to caveat that by saying any Bluetooth headphone that I have, I've tested with it, with a volume up key works. I'm sure somebody will write in to say that they found a set of headphones that doesn't work. But in principle, the idea is that the volume up key takes the photograph irrelevant of the device.
Well, that's very good. I'm impressed with that. Good one. Mr. Shadwell, what is your cool thing?
Tip? Quite often I'm asked by friends to go and solve a problem in their house where they've got the Wi-Fi set up, but one room or another or somewhere in the house is a dead spot.
Mm.
So I actually use a tool that I... this is a recommendation that I got from the guys who installed all the Wi-Fi at the Open last year. And it's a free app. It's called NetSpot. It's got in-app purchase if you want to go for the pro levels, but for most personal use, it works pretty good just using the free version. So it will show you all the Wi-Fi hotspots or the all the Wi-Fi units that you have in the house, if and where they are, what frequency they're on, what channel they're on. It works with all of the standards, including AC. So what I would do is it only runs on a Mac, unfortunately. They are working on an Android and an iPad version. But you can walk around the house and it will show you the signal strength of all the different Wi-Fi hotspots. And it's very useful. You can even you can set up a map of the floor area, the rooms, of the building or whatever. And you can go into different parts of the room and do a test to see what levels the signals are and where the dead spots are. So then you can say, okay, you can move your hotspots around to make it better.
I've got to get a shooting grip. Paul Shadwell has one as well, says Mac Vader. And also Wind Rider's saying you've wrecked his morning, Paul Wheatley, because he's going to sit and try that now first. Good tip, Paul. I like that one. I'm going to give that a go because I get a lot of problems with the Apple box around the house. Some places are great, some places are crap, unfortunately. Mr. Holtzman, do you have a cool tip?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I encounter a lot as a technician is when I go to the customer's location and I remove all this unwanted software that was previously mentioned, things like toolbars and coupon printer for Windows and all this other stuff. People say, how did I get that? I say, well, I don't know how you got it. I wasn't looking over your shoulder when it happened. I have no idea how you got that. But more than likely, what happened was they downloaded something that was free. I put free in quotes there. And it came with some add-on sponsorship type deals that helps pay for the program. So Java, for example, likes to always add on like the McAfee security tool or the Ask toolbar, Adobe. Flash will try and throw on Google Chrome. Well, there's this great free program called Unchecky, and it's available at unchecky.com. And what it does is for the most common programs that people download, free programs, it automatically unchecks those unwanted programs during the installation process. So all you have to do is keep clicking next until the program is installed. uTorrent is another one. You go to download uTorrent. It tries to install like 8 different things onto your computer that are completely unrelated to uTorrent, and it will automatically uncheck all those boxes so that you can continue to be ignorant and click next, 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 finish, and not have to worry about unwanted software on your computer. And it works, like I say, with just the most popular applications. And I understand that list is always growing. They're always improving it. And it's completely free. And when you install Unchecky, you don't have to uncheck any boxes of unwanted software. You just click next until it's done. And excellent. It just sits in the background and forget it's even there.
Brilliant. Good tech, mate. Unchecky.com. Thank you for putting it in the dock, Paul. My tip is one that I've always heard about. You know, when someone says to you, oh, you can do that. And you're like, yeah, that's the king's new clothes. I don't believe for one second that's actually going to work. Well, last week, my lad, Ellis, decided that he wanted a hot chocolate while he was playing Minecraft up in his room. And he dropped something on the floor. So he bent down to pick it up. And as he came up, he put his hand on the table to hold onto the table, because obviously being old, his knees are bad at 10. And he knocked his hot chocolate over into his keyboard, which is a wired keyboard. And the wired keyboard went into the back of his iMac, and everything stopped working. Holy crap. Well, it's an accident. It's okay. It's fine. So I unplugged the keyboard, and I'm well aware of the fact that I've heard the thing about you can take a keyboard and you can put it in the dishwasher. And providing there's no power in it, it'll be just fine. So if you've got a wired keyboard, it's great because there's nothing there. But if you've got one of the Bluetooth keyboards, you've got to take the batteries out first. But if you take the batteries out, make sure you leave the end cap off. You can stick it in a dishwasher and wash it. So I take this thing, because it's not working anyway at this point, and I stick it in the top tray of the dishwasher. And I run the dishwasher. And the keyboard was washed in the dishwasher. It spent 4 days drying out in the sun and on the radiator. And then we plugged it back in. Works a treat. It nice. Works. It absolutely works. It is not the king's new clothes. I have a keyboard that I've put in the dishwasher, and it works. It cleans
actually did
it.
A video on that a couple of years ago to
and?
Test whether that myth was true or not. In my experience, about 8 out of 10 keyboards will come out okay. Don't put the dryer heat on the dishwasher.
We just ran it on a full. I just put it on a full intense cycle, and that was it. So it does
yeah,
the
but
steam
you didn't
dry.
Let it dry. You didn't like have the sanitized heat.
Yeah, it was a steam dry cycle and everything, yeah. It came out and it was piping hot.
Yeah, I wouldn't have done the steam dry. Usually heat.
I live on the edge of me, Kerry.
Yeah, yeah, but you right there. But yes, primarily with wired keyboards. And again, when it's damaged, you've got nothing to lose. And also, don't wash anything else in your dishwasher.
No, there was cups and all just, kinds of crap in there. There was breakfast cornflakes and everything.
No, that's wrong.
Well, maybe the cornflake was helping make the contact on the B key or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, but those aren't food safe plastics that are your keyboard's made of. So who knows what cancers you're giving yourself? I recommend just washing the keyboard by itself, and it may or it may not resolve it. But if the keyboard's broken already, it may in fact resolve it.
Or you can listen to the dickhead who did it and it worked. So listen
not,
to the sane
I'm not
advice.
Saying it's, I'm just saying I would have done it a little safer.
Yeah. We've all got solder in our breakfast now. That's what you're saying. That's brilliant. Thank you, Matt. If you've got a question for us, we do need questions. We were lucky today because we tweeted out and a few people wrote in. So thank you very much to those people that did. And thanks to the people who sent questions in prior to that. Send it to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com. And we'll put it in the dock, and we'll have our assembled panel of experts help you out, because they're a real good bunch. We try and get an eclectic mix of people that know their stuff, and we have this week. I was going to take the piss, but we have this week. We've got a great bunch here who've got a very, very wide knowledge. If you've got photography questions, that allows me to not look like an idiot. So please send the odd one in. That'd be grand. Until that point, though, Mr. Holtzman, where can we get a hold of you?
You can check out my latest reviews and how-to videos, building a computer, at my YouTube channel, which I just forwarded from kerryholzman.com. And be sure and check out my podcast, TechVets, tech-vets.com, which is all about the trials and tribulations of running your own computer repair business.
Yeah, no help there, just complaints.
Do what you're good at.
Next to Paul, where are we getting you, mate?
Which Paul?
Paul Shadwell, sorry. Slim Shadwell.
We went the whole show.
Yes, you couldn't let it lie.
No, it never will.
just a side point, I've just plugged in my headphones into my iPhone, and that also works with the taking the pictures.
Oh, there you
sorry,
go.
I should have said that it does work with the actual headphones, but it also works with Bluetooth too.
To be fair, as well, just to back that up, Windrider in the chat room says he's used his Logitech K760BT keyboard, which is the one that I've got here, because I bought that on Paul Wheatley and Windrider's recommendation, and I've got to say it's sat in a dark room all week and it still bloody works. I have no idea how this thing powers. It's powered by the devil. There we go.
Unicorns.
Unicorns. It's powered by unicorns and the devil. The devil riding a unicorn. There we go. And it also takes pictures with the plus key, thanks to Windrider. Sorry, carry on. Where are you?
Probably best bet is to get me on Twitter. It's Paul Shadwell, PaulShadwell.
Thank you very much.
What about your alter ego? You're not going to plug his Twitter account?
No. At Slim Shadwell, which is, of course, updated by Paul when he does his gangster rap. Booyah. Windrider says an X is a has-been and a spurt is a drip under pressure. You can get stuffed, mate. Mr. Wheatley, where are you, buddy? Smack in the middle.
You can find me at Paul Wheatley on Twitter or on The Gamer Show or Pocket Shows on this network and also occasionally on some other shows.
Now, Pocket Show, well worth a listen this week. What a panel you had.
It was a good panel. We had some audio issues, so apologies for that if anybody is offended in any way about that. But it was a great conversation. So we had Chris Ashley from the SMR podcast, Adam Christensen from the MacCast, and Jason Howell from All About Android on Twit.
I haven't listened to it yet. I've got it. It's on the drive for tomorrow. So don't spoil it, but well worth listening.
It is. It is. It was well worth listening. It was really good having those guys on. There was some really good discussion. I've said my Twitter. Yeah.
There's a point there as well. One of the things that makes a huge difference to the network is things like just putting reviews up in iTunes. It makes a huge difference to our rankings, and most of our people, I think, probably find us through iTunes or through recommendations. So please, please, please give us a review. Whatever you want to review us as, that's fine. Help Show needs reviews as well. We'll read them out, good or bad. We always do. And the Gamer Show, the Help Show, those kind of things, the Pocket Show, all of those things are big, big shows for the network and very helpful as well as. Please support them with your love and your reviews, not just the Max Show, which is the one that seems to attract all the attention. But that's for a different reason. We'll move on. Mr. Griffin, where are you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Darren Griffin, also at macfixer.co.uk, and of course, pocketgpsworld.com.
Yeah, definitely. And last but by no means least, Righty Boy.
You'll find me on Twitter, Paulums, and just hanging around here at BTN.
And I heard a rumour that you might be starting something new.
Looking into it, we're. Things will happen very soon.
Did I hear the rumour that actually Mr. Holtzman might be a good addition or Mr. Shadwell might be a good addition?
May well be. Yeah, we'll keep going for a little longer.
Yeah. We've got a new show coming along and Wrighty's going to be the lead on that potentially.
God help us.
We're going to make it up as we go along, I guess. Yeah. My name's Ewan Rankin. You can get me at Ewan Rankin on Twitter. We'll be back in 2 weeks with the Health Show. If you've got a question, send it to bridgetechnetwork@gmail.com. Meanwhile, the London Mac User Group on the 2nd of June, I think we've got one more show before then, so we're all right, but 2nd of June, they've hired out the London Transport Museum, and we're going to be there for the keynote live. We're going to be doing a podcast from there. I will be there. We will be streaming out live, and also... you'll be able to see Tim on the big screen. It's a 25-foot screen in that auditorium, and there's room for 200 people in the theatre, and then we're going for beer afterwards. So if you can get to London on the 2nd of June, I would suggest you do. And the thing is, it's £5 to get in if you're a non-member. It's only 15 quid to be a member for the whole year anyway. But if you pay your 5 quid for membership on the night, then you also get to go around the London Transport Museum free of charge, which is pretty cool. So come and see us, 2nd of June, London Transport Museum. Don't be late. We'll see you again in 2 weeks' time. Send the questions in. Thanks for listening.